This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
We're so grateful to be able to have our third Astrobiotechnology Hub event. When we started working in space, Allison Motry and I, with our first I-SCORE grant from NASA and ISS National Labs, we couldn't imagine what a strong community this is and how we work around the clock together to get really spectacular science done. And it feels like art a lot of the time when we get our images and our data back. And that's why we're having this meeting in the Museum of Contemporary Art. We've got to combine the art of science and medicine and think about what we're doing together. And the great thing about the space community is we have to work together. It's such a complex environment, but on the other hand, it also accelerates discovery. And they're completely new discoveries, right? Mr. Cohn at the back, he knows this. So we have a number of people who have worked in space, and we'll provide some interesting insights today. We're very fortunate to have our Vice Chancellor of Health Sciences, who works on pre-cancer and the genomic predisposition that a lot of us have to cancer. He's way ahead of his time, has been working on this, leading the field, but most importantly, leading us into a whole new era of how we bring the best science to the clinic. And so we're thrilled to have you here. We also have patient advocates here who will be involved in the first panel, who will tell us why it matters. And then Sheldon Morris will host that panel. Then we'll move over to the science panel, no pressure people, who are going to show us the latest and greatest from the results from space. So we have Space Tango, NASA, KAUST, so the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Saudi Space Agency represented, ISS National Labs, Axiom, and Celestial Strategies represented. And then we'll have a little closing remarks session with a Q&A. Everybody can answer questions, and don't be shy about asking them, because this is a new field. And then we'll move on to having a bit of a break before we get into the Medicine Informing Novel Discoveries event, MIND event, where Allison Motry and I will talk about updates. We'll also have one of our top philanthropists speaking about why it matters to fund the best science to get to the clinic. And then we'll end with a patient story as well. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. John Carruthers. Thank you so much for being here.
I just want to say thank you, Kat. Isn't this such a wonderful setting? Do you all agree? We're all fantastic. I've been here 2 years, so I'm just as old as this year, 2 year milestone, on this third annual Global Astrotechnology Hub, and it's great to be here with all of the partners that are working with our Stem Cell Institute and Kat Jameson, and we take pride in hosting this event here at this Contemporary Museum of Art, bringing all of you, our clinical experts, our space specialists, and of course, the research to tie it all together to make translational events happen and help patients. I know this happens here on Earth, but it also happens in low Earth orbit. I know that's part of this, but to benefit people here on Earth. And I really want to thank our donor that Kat runs the Institute, the T. Denny Sanford, for his generosity in establishing the Institute. But on behalf of Kat and Allison, I extend a warm welcome to all of you participating here in this this meeting today. This significant milestone is one of our ongoing journeys here at UC San Diego, and it underscores our relationship with all of you for Space Tango, Axiom, Sierra Space, NASA, CASES, and others. And I'll tell you, walking into this room, and I just casually met a few people who are so excited about learning what is going on here in San Diego, in this Sanford Stem Cell Institute, and how they can effectualize that for their futures and the future patients. These partnerships pave the way for wonderful, groundbreaking research. And it has a positive impact on the lives. But we are an integrated health system here in San Diego, and we see things going from bitch to bedside, maybe from space to bedside as well. And I want to mention that over the last year, particularly the Sanford Integrated Space Stem Cell Orbital Research, or ISCOR Center, Allison's the director of that, and Kat Jameson flew payloads on CRS-31 with Space Tango and AX-3 with Axiom Space, several research payloads, and some of that work is coming back to affect our patients. Issues on microgravity, accelerated aging, the development and care of human organoids, as well as how it's effects on cancer. I am thrilled that on this special occasion, we can delve into what Kat said, the intersection of science and art and space exploration. And I want all of you to engage in a thought-provoking exchange with many of the sessions that you're going to have this afternoon, particularly with our patients and patient advocates, and all of you in the room who are leading space experts, to explore all the latest advancements that you can think of and hopefully implement in the near-term future. Your participation here adds great value, not only to what the Stem Cell Institute and this partnership does, but again, to the value of patients for the future. So I want to thank you for your welcome, and I hope you have a wonderful seminar and discussion today. I think you'll find it well worth it in your time here. Thank you very much, and thank you, Director Jameson.
Okay, hello. I'm Sheldon Morris. I'm the director of the Sanford Stem Cell Clinical Center. So what we do is we are doing those clinical trials for where we're trying to translate, treatments for patients. And like right now, we support about 37 different trials. And so that's why we are looking to you to bring some new, treatments, new cures that are informed through research in low Earth orbit and beyond, so that we can cure more patients, because it's sort of a new dimension. So what we're going to do is bring up three of our patient advocates. So come on up, guys. We've got Alex, Noah, and Justin. So these are the people of why we do what we do, basically, and why we want to have bring future treatments to patients all across the world. So I'm going to ask you guys to introduce yourselves, and I'm going to have you tell us why you think it's important to have science in space, or if that's too big a question, however you want to, why science helps at all. Go ahead. Well, start over here.
Hi, I'm Noah Campillo. I'm a UCLA student. I think that I've been taking, like, last year I took exercise courses, and one of the people who taught them was always like, when at the last push, it was like, we can do hard things. That's why we're here. Like, you can do hard things. And I don't think space research is very easy, but it's doing tons of things for us. And it's hard, but we can do hard things. So I think that's very important. To keep that in mind of everyone's doing hard things, patients, researchers, doctors, but it's all paying off. It ends in something good happening. So that's what I think.
Hi, I'm Alex Allen. I am a software engineer at an oncology company. And echoing what you said, I think I'm going to even take it one step further. It's not every day I get to say, oh, well, my medication was made in space, so take your aspirin. I'm going to take my space drugs, and I'm going to feel much better about myself. The medication and the developments that are happening through the research that's happening in space is really relevant, but it also makes me feel very seen as a patient, because it's not often when you have like a rare disorder like I do, it's not often that you feel like you can explain what it is or even you can share with other people how often it happens. And so with the research that's happening in space right now and with all the work that's been done with NASA, it's really, really nice for me able to say, I have this and NASA is working on it. So thank you guys.
I'm Justin Graves. I guess I've had a lot of medical history in my family, and that was one of the big things that got me started into this. Didn't really think about it too much. It just kind of easy answer. I want to help people, and I'm glad all of you do. And then this new step that we're taking in the space, all the advancements we can make, all the different people we can help, and what's going to come in years, what we'll find out, what we'll learn, what else we'll be able to do. So really excited about where this is going to all go. And just all the benefits that can really come from this, not just with the patients, just everyone being able to learn a bit more about it all. So thank you guys.
Thank you so much. We have at least another 10 minutes to talk, but I thought maybe you could ask, why did you guys decide that you'd want to step up and be a patient advocate? What drives you to do that?
I guess my biggest thing was I wanted to help other people. It's always been a passion for me. Like I said, when they asked me to be involved in this, it was just a quick answer. Didn't really think about it too much. It was just I can help advance this and do a lot for the other people out there. And so that was a big thing that really got me to make that decision. And yes, it was several months after that I really thought about everything else. And I guess it may be a little risky, but if it's getting to the trials with humans, figured had to be safe enough. So wanted to help everyone else out there. Thanks.
Yeah, from my side, I got my start in biotechnology more than 10 years ago. And I started at Illumina working on the genetic sequencers there. And for me, just like I think all of you, sometimes the work is really fun and sometimes it's really interesting and sometimes it's really hard and really frustrating. And sometimes you can feel just ground down. But every time I got to hear a patient advocate speak, every time I got to see that I was actually making a difference, you know, even that one meeting I wish I didn't have to go to every week, you know, even that, if I got to see what a difference my work was doing, it made a huge difference for me. It made me want to go to work, and it made me go to work with a smile and know that what I did mattered. So when I got the chance, after discovering I had a rare genetic disorder, after working in genetics for a while, when I got the chance to be a patient advocate for CAT, I jumped on it. Because if even one person in this audience feels like me and hearing a patient speak about how much better their life is because of you, if I can bring that to this group, then I've made a huge difference and I'm very happy.
So I was diagnosed when I was 16 and I started going through like pediatrics, and it was a lot of conversations, even as a 16-year-old, where I was being talked about and not talked to through some of my doctors. And then when I started seeing Dr. Jameson, it was kind of scary because I was being talked to and my mom was not answering all the questions for me. So at that point, I realized how important it was to be included in your own care. And that's why I am a patient advocate, especially pediatric patient advocate, because it's so important to everyone to truly know what is happening to them and what their options are. So I think it's super important. That's also why in the future I want to go into medicine as well, just so I know that there are people who truly care about the patient and what is happening in their lives.
Well, that those are all very good reasons. I think one of the thing, another question I thought I had was to ask is if there's something like that's happened in the past few years that you thought really stuck out as a real interesting or really important change in science relating to space or anything, what would that be that really piqued your interest?
I'll take that one first. I get to come to a lot of these because I'm local, so I'm kind of spoiled, but I got to attend one with Dr. Motri, and you talked about your tiny brains in space, and I gotta tell you, I was so excited about the tiny brains in space. I was working on a clinical trial for Rett syndrome, and you spoke about what you were doing there, and I mean, it never even occurred to me that maybe we could test Rett medication on, again, mini space brains. These are things that don't sound real to me as a software engineer working with clinicians, but I got to sit through an entire conversation. I went back to work the next day just the happiest little clam telling everybody all about this. Guys, did everyone know about these tiny space brains and how they're going to absolutely save all these children? And honestly, it was just so motivating for me. So that was very exciting stuff.
So for me, I think just coming to all of these as well, it's been super great to year after year see the developments in certain people's research and what those developments have going towards the future, and just really seeing this whole project grow and progress.
Thank you. You've
read in the news too.
What was that question again?
You know, there's something that jumps out of you, like you're a wow moment, like that an advancement that you saw in the news or on a talk or.
I mean, just myself was an incredible advancement to me. Everything that changed in my life with my seizures, I thought I was having it pretty good, pretty lucky, able to function, do a lot. Obviously, couldn't drive. I had to give up my dream career as being a scuba instructor. And so getting into something like this, I hope we're able to make those advancements, hopefully help some people. You know, scuba diving's a big thing to me. I would love to see more people able to do that. It's got to be the biggest thing for me, is just how much it's helped everyone else and the advancements everyone's making.
All right. Well, thank you for that. How about, is there any other thing you'd want to add or any other thing that you're marching orders for all these people, what they need to be doing?
Oh, man. I guess it's really just get more people involved. That's what I would like to see. And so this isn't such, at least in my mind, such a smaller group that's really working on this frontier. So just bringing some more awareness and interest to the rest of the people out there, whether they're in the field or not.
Yeah, I think the industry has done an incredible job, and this institute in particular has always made me feel really welcome and made me feel like I have a voice here as equal as everyone else, which as a patient advocating for my own care is incredible. And then as a scientist in a different field is exciting just to get to witness what's going on. I think that we've done a great job as an industry of bringing in patient advocates. Now I would love to see next us become a patient collective in a way. Like, we talked for 5 minutes and I have so much in common with these two. And just as a patient network, I mean, when you have a rare disorder or a disorder that is difficult to treat, it's so incredible to have connections. And so I think building a patient network that's not just tied to a provider, but tied to a community, I think that would be a really cool advancement for us.
This quarter, I started in a neurological research lab, and every time I'm shadowing my lab manager, I'm asking questions about what happens if you do this to these cells or you do this to these organoids, and it's always like, I don't know, that's a good question. We should try that. And it made me realize how much more avenues that we could explore. Before I got into doing research or just studying anything, I thought, oh, all of science is pretty much figured out. All of research figured out. Everything is going. I would have to find a very specific niche to create something new. But really, there's something new everywhere. So if I were to say one thing is for everyone who's conducting research, for everyone who is even has ideas towards research, there's so many more spots that we could fill and that has so many different types of ideas and open spaces that are ready to be filled. So expand.
Well, thank you, Noah, Justin, Alex. You are why we do what we do. So I'm so happy that you guys came today and gave us the message and gave us our marching orders. Kat, did you want to come up, or who's next here?
Thank you, Dr. Morris and Dr. Carruthers and Noah and Alex and Justin. Do you see why this place is so special? We have people that are undaunted by difficulty, even when they're faced with really tough circumstances for themselves. It's always this altruism, this bravery that we keep encountering in the clinic that drives us back to the lab. So as Larry Goldstein always has repeatedly taught me, the great science leads to great medicine. But if we don't know why we're doing what we're doing, it will go nowhere. So we decided to start with why. And why we have a unique opportunity to get things right here and to get things right together. We've got a vice chancellor who's undaunted by difficulty. Thank you, Dr. Carruthers. I also wanted to echo the words of Alicia Keys. DEI is a gift. It's not a weakness. Having diversity, having differences of opinion, particularly when it comes to science, because there are a lot of holes to fill. And to be able to work in diverse environments with people that come from different walks of life, this is our strength. And having people have agency, as Sandra always reminds me of, that you get to choose what you would take or build things that we would actually take if we find we're in a difficult position. Now that you're becoming researchers with us, you're going to help develop this path forward in the most unusual places in that space. Because the people you'll see from our space industry, from NASA, have always had to work in tough environments, right, Paul? Yes, from SpaceX. Elena from SpaceX is here. So they don't give up because it's hard. We do it because it's hard, because no one else will do it, because no one will ask the tough questions. And we are in a very fortunate environment here where we're allowed to ask the tough questions. We don't have to be the cool kids all the time. I'm almost never a cool kid. That would be cool if I were a cool kid, but we're allowed to ask the really perplexing, challenging questions and have a collective. Have a collective of patient advocates who have become researchers, clearly, but also have a collective of scientists, physicians, administrators, everyone working together to make sure we get the right answer. So remember, space is an accelerating environment, and it's accelerating because you have rocket scientists, they're pretty smart, but you have people who work together to find new biology in space that really helps us answer tough questions on the ground. So with that, I'd like to invite our panelists up here. We've got Twyman Clements, who's here from Space Tango. Thanks. Come on up, Twyman. So I'll have everybody come and sit on the stage. Everybody can give a little bit of a talk just for a few minutes to frame the conversation. So please join us, Twyman. So Twyman is the CEO of Space Tango. We always love the name, so we had to work with Twyman. We've been working together since 2020. We've got Sylvain Costas, who works on radiation biology and has had a long career at NASA. Thank you, Sylvain. We've got Imed Galusi, who also speaks French because he spent a number of years as a professor at McGill in Montreal. Ça marche?
Je parle français
un petit peu. Oui, moi aussi. And then we've got Davide Murata. Thank you for being here. So he's our friend at ISS National Labs and ensures that all of our science has the right rigor, reliability, and reproducibility to fly, because it's a big deal to fly these experiments and get them done. We've got Pete Armesky, who actually we've known for a long time because she trained with Allison Motry and has taken off in her illustrious career with Axiom, and we're just thrilled to keep working with you, Pinar. Thank you for being here. And then Jana Studemeyer, who started all of this. So Jana has led the way to get back to Noah's point. We do things even if they're hard, maybe because they're hard, because nobody else will take on these challenges. Cancer is hard. Rett syndrome's hard. You know, aging is hard. We had a little shindig last night. I was feeling like I need an anti-aging strategy this morning. So if anybody has something, please step up. And, you know, we have people that are working incredibly hard together. And that collective idea, Alex, thank you. We will take you up on that. Noah, we will be as brave as you are about finding the holes, because there are many in science, but also in the clinic. And Justin, thank you for taking on the risk of being on a clinical trial. You led the way there. So this kind of bravery, we have to match. We have to match in science. So, you know, ISS National Labs, NASA gave us Velcro. They gave us advanced materials that are allow our phones to work. They gave us all sorts of technologies that will determine how we do quantum computing. There's so much more to learn. And we are a global hub, so we're really thrilled to have the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia represented in MEN. Thank you for being here. He is the mentor for Rihanna, who is the 600th person to reach the ISS National Labs. And she'd never seen a launch back to bravery, Noah, before she'd been in it. So that's a little above and beyond, literally. But she is an incredible astronaut. So I'd like to start by asking everybody to introduce themselves. So we'll start with Sylvain, because he's just closer to me. And we'll just give you a little introduction, then we'll go around.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sylvain Coste. I'm the former data officer for Space Bio and Physical Science at NASA headquarters. And I was also the project manager for Open Science for many years. And I also have a lab called the Radiation Biophysics Lab. And you hear a bit more about this later.
Hello, everyone. My name is Davide Marotta. I'm the Program Director for In-Space Biomanufacturing at the ISS National Lab. And I'm a scientist. I used to work at the bench with stem cells and brain organoids. So I have four payloads trying to understand neurodegeneration. So In-Space was helping us. And that what brought me here on the other side of science, like on the dark side in space.
Hello, everyone. My name is Pinar Messi. I'm the Senior Program Manager of In-Space Biomanufacturing at Axiom Space. And similar to Davide, we actually had a pretty similar parallel path. And I'm very happy to be now coming full circle, starting with Allison and then working with Jenna, Twyman, Shelby, and then now coming to the Axiom on the other side, helping with the science.
Hi, everybody. Imed Geluzi. I'm from King Abdullah University Science Technology. It's at Saudi Arabia. I'll tell you a little bit more about it later. I'm an RNA binding protein expert. I've been doing this for 30 years, but also an aspiring astrobiologist. And I will tell you, and because of Rihanna joined my lab a few months ago to do her PhD, hoping to send her back to space with her own experiment. And I'll tell you more what's in the plan.
All right. My name's Twyman Clements. I am the co-founder and president of Space Tango. And what we do is we take ideas like those being generated here, Dr. Jameson, Dr. Motry, and many others, and we implement them in spacecraft, the International Space Station or any other spacecraft like that. So I'm not a scientist, but I've worked with many. I'm an trained engineer. And just how we take those ideas and operate them in zero gravity and sometimes 4 or 5 Gs when it's launching or when it's coming home. So that we can deliver good science and move the state of the art and the work of our customers are doing forward. So, and I've had the honor to work with many of the people on this stage and in this crowd. So thank you, including Jana.
Hey, exactly. So I'm Jana Studemeyer. I am currently transitioned from Axiom recently, but have had a long career in space. As Twyman said, I've had an opportunity to work with Space Tango directly, also ISS National Lab. Prior to that, I was part of the biotech community here in San Diego. And my transition to space was really because I can see where we still have challenges that we can't answer here on Earth. And when you talked about asking the questions and there's, you know, oh, they're all answered, far from it. But for me, the innovation, when I would hear someone talk about innovation here on the ground, you know, there's nothing like changing your whole perspective on science. And one of the most rewarding things for me in getting to work with all of the teams that are here, and Allison, our first experiment that went to the International Space Station was fantastic, because not only were there results that were kind of unexpected, but that change in the perspective of your science and how you ask questions of that really is what keeps me very motivated to keep doing this. So pleased to be here today.
And we're going to make this very interactive. We'll go around with a microphone and make sure that everybody can ask questions, because this is an unusual opportunity to ask really tough questions just because it's fun. but also because you may come up with things that we haven't thought of. You know, we've been living in this space literally and figuratively for a few years. And, you know, maybe Alex says something and she goes, wait a minute, what about genomics in space? But, you know, we have lots of opportunities to really just pitch in and ask questions. So I'll start with the same question to every single person. And start with Steve Vann, just because he's closest. Why space? What have you learned in space that's different from on the ground? Why should we work in such an extreme environment?
That's a tough question. Okay, so there's some changes in space that are really interesting. The space seems to be acting like an accelerator of aging. So you heard about the telomere story, where actually it looks like we are getting younger, but that's kind of an artifact from the rest of the data, which really suggests that actually we are aging in space very fast. Mitochondria seems to be the hub that actually is responding to this change. And the combination of microgravity and radiation together is really interesting. And the microgravity actually is really confusing, because you see this kind of a reactive oxygen species being released in the tissue. And people are still looking at, you know, is it changes in the cytoplasmic structure that a physical force that really is triggering this effect? On top of it, you have the radiation. So, for instance, for stem cell in the breast, if you have a signal of radiation, will induce self-renewing signals, which means that your stem cells will be more likely to self-renew instead of doing a you know, asymmetric division. And that's something you're going to see in space more than on the ground. So that's been shown with radiation. So the big question is, when you bring microgravity and radiation together, you really are now exploring something that is impossible to see here. It's just not possible. And the other thing is, on organoid, you're really benefiting from this structure where you don't need cell and suspension grow very well in space, because they're in the natural environment. And so I think there's a lot of opportunities. I think organ growing is going to be another huge thing in space. Whoever can take advantage of this, kind of like you know, when you're in a baby, an embryo, you are in this kind of environment. So I think there's so many opportunities with space that I think haven't been explored too much yet.
To 3D.
Right. No, yeah, all the above. And I like you brought up the pregnancy, because one professor of mine back in Sicily used to say the same, like, it's like being in space with a hand lady. I don't know that. But yeah, and also, like, microgravity is an accelerator of condition and accelerator of innovation. So everything that we are studying in microgravity happened faster. And for us, it's very important, because we have patients here on Earth. You know, we don't have 2 years, 3 years to wait for a new drug. We need new solutions, and we need them now. So yeah, I want to add this to what Sylvain said.
Yeah, I'm just going to echo a little bit. I completely agree with both of you. And just to add on that, I mean, there's a lot of processes that we are doing, like innovative technologies like stem cells, for instance. We are all using them, but then there's still hurdles in them. So space can be a way to find better, to make the process better. For instance, this is some of the work that we're doing with Dr. Arun Sharma, who is also here, with the Cedars-Sinai team, the cellular reprogramming, can we improve that? And if we do, we might be able to do all these cellular therapies, for instance, in a much faster pace. But it's also to try to find how we can make some of the products that we cannot make as perfectly possible as we can on the ground. I saw Kobe from Auxilium. They actually just sent a bioprinter as well, and they successfully bioprinted 8 medical devices during a record time. So these are the types of things that we can do in microgravity that we're not necessarily able to do here on Earth. There's many more examples, but I just didn't want to hog the whole conversation.
So for me, it's a simple but also hard question to answer for somebody who's new in this. So I discovered space when Rayana approached me with the question, can we do PhD? And that the timing came that Saudi Arabia and the Saudi Space Agency has a really now big push to create a microgravity research in Saudi Arabia. So building on that, my interest as a scientist has been for the last 25 years is muscle and muscle formation, muscle development, but also muscle wasting. And you know, I mean, when astronauts go to space, very fast they start losing their muscle mass. But then when they come back, also fast few weeks later, they recover. So the question I'm asking, and I hopefully we can address, what are the mechanisms that really make our cells lose muscle fast but also recover it? Can we apply this to diseases like sarcopenia or cancer-induced muscle wasting? In fact, I mean, if I put my kid brain and science fiction, can we use, for example, in the future, hospitals in space where we send sarcopenic patients that space can reprogram their satellite cells, and when they come back, maybe they can recover the muscle they lost? A question to be answered, experiment to be done. That's what drives me and really pushed me to do this.
Yeah, so I think the why space, you'd answer it like we do with many of our customers, which is, you know, space and zero gravity are interrelated but different concepts. And so we're going to space to achieve a zero gravity environment. And that's removing one of the four fundamental forces of the universe, the strong and weak nuclear forces, which are pretty chaotic if you're messing with those, electromagnetism, and then gravity. And that changes density, settling, hydrostatic pressure, other things like that. And so that's what we walk through with our customers is what of your process does those change and how do we look through that? So the why space is really looking at what changes in the physics and how that affects a process or a signaling in biological systems, or a big thing in materials is that you don't get convective heat flow. And so you can have very laminar reactions at very high temperatures next to each other. So that's the why space and the pitch we give with our customers. So.
And I'm going to take it just a little bit differently, because you've heard about why space from a science perspective, but why space and why now? We're really building on a decade of results of what's been done on the ISS. A lot of that has been looking at human health and trying to understand human health for future exploration. But what we've found is that there's a lot to the benefit to life on Earth in the science, just like Kat was mentioning about, you know, our cell phones. We touch space every day with your cell phone, but you're probably not even thinking about that when you do it. And there's a lot of products. My favorite is the ear thermometer that we all use, but that came from space because there was no other way to take temperature. But when you think about the opportunities that we have to leverage that science and understanding to benefit to life on Earth, the ISS is a one-of-a-kind scientific facility, and there's more coming. There's Axiom Space building a space station. There's Starlab that's building a space station. There's vehicles like Dream Chaser that can help to get us up there. SpaceX, fantastic, already gives us access to that environment. But the future is a transition from the ISS that hopefully is even better and gives us more opportunity.
So we talked about the benefits of humanity or benefits of space for humanity on Earth. What about the benefits of space just for space? What about understanding whether or not we're going to occupy Mars, as I saw when we were at a restaurant with Paul and Elena at Starbase? Is that going to be possible? What are your thoughts, Sylvain? Because it sounds like we can't simulate microgravity. What can we do to develop countermeasures for microgravity radiation, especially as we get beyond the Earth's orbit, closer to cislunar environments, and then beyond? Is this something that's humanly possible? Are we going to have to turn to Alex and understand how we can have an AI-driven algorithm to have our thoughts embedded in a computer?
Okay, so living on Moon and Mars, so altered gravity, I think there's going to be a lot of challenges with this. And we know that SpaceX has a very big agenda. They want to colonize Mars. I think the division I was at NASA will play a big role there, because space biology is going to be essential to understand how you're going to grow plants. We can't bring everything to Mars for sure. There's going to be challenges in terms of communications. There's about a 30-minute delay between anything that happens on Mars and when you can talk to them. So basically, we're going to have self-driving lab. We're going to have, probably AI doctors that's going to help the patient. And a lot of this work is happening right now. We have some, we're using large language models to try to curate information about medical activities, medical actions. So I think it will be possible, but it's going to take a bit of time. And Moon is great because we're going to be able to experiment a lot of these concepts on the Moon first. And that's what you probably heard from NASA, Moon first, Mars second. And I think it's going to be really important that we try Moon. Now, one thing, bringing back to Earth, I think our planet is becoming very difficult to live in, as you can see, right? The dryness and everything. So I think some of the things we're learning from living in extreme environment will be also applicable directly to us on Earth. And I think this is the other thing that we need to remind people, is that whatever we're going to do in space will have some true application. Being able to deploy very easy, structure that can be very resilient on Earth is going to be essential when you have something like the fire we just had. Where do you put these people? Is there any structure we can leverage? So it's not only health, it's also the entire logistic that comes with living in space, and I think it's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, let me say that ISS National Lab main goal is Earth, space for Earth. So our goal is terrestrial benefits. But if I think space for space, well, all the the biomedical R&D we are doing on board of the station, all the bioprinting, regenerative medicine, the avenues of automation and reprogramming for stem cells in space, that will be all beneficial for deep space exploration, where one of the major difficulties is going to be the distance from Earth. Like, hey, I need a batch of stem cells. Yeah, in 8 months, we will have it. So we need to have something on board or on the base camp on Mars that able to, fully produce and reprogram your stem cells so you can feed your bioprinting machine, for example, and have your liver ready for the people living there.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be really important to become self-sustained. And also from if we think of it from a medical point of view, being able to look at that at all times if you have any type of condition, like some of the health types of experiments, I think, like the ones that Dr. Jameson has been pioneering with Axiom Space over the first 3 Axiom private astronaut missions, but also in the next one in AX4. I think those are going to be very important in the future as well, especially with the distance and being far away from Earth and all the resources that we have here.
So I think this reminds me discussions we had a few months ago, and I've been asking to Arun and Alison some provocative questions. Technically, I think I believe is space, probably the adaptation to space, and technologically we will solve it with time, with AI and with all the technology. But the question we have is around our biology, or how human can adapt in space. For example, can we reproduce in space if we are going to colonize Mars? That's a question needs to be addressed. I ask this question too many times. I don't know whether anybody knows that the answer to that. We don't know. Through probably brain organoid what Alison is developing, we can solve a problem of adaptation and aging, probably find solution. But for example, if you send human to Mars, probably it's better that they reproduce there to build the colony. Is it feasible? That's my the question, not an answer.
Well, I think just answering it from a capability perspective, there are studies beginning, and some have been done on the ISS that use human models or other subsystems or other organ models to see how those are affected. Right now in low Earth orbit, which you're under the Van Allen belt, you're not getting as much radiation, but there are studies planned for longer duration on the ISS of some of those organs, and then some of those starting to go to translunar injection as well as transmartian injection. So I think they'll start there with those models and before you know, they start sending the full people. So
yeah, and I mean, I would just say, I didn't think 10 years ago that we would have the type of access that we have to microgravity. So when I think 10 years forward to what it's going to look like to go to Moon or Mars, it's probably not an 8-month delay, right? It's probably going to be a quicker rocket. It's probably going to be capabilities that will be developed by advanced materials that will develop in space that will give us less delay in those communications. But it's going to be a make it, don't take it kind of opportunity as well for the science. So I think that's going to be very important. And when I think about even now, so everyone just saw this was a historic week because we had Firefly Ghost Rider landed on the moon, which is the second payload that's been landed on the moon. The first payload was Intuitive Machines that made it up there. And I think everybody remembers kind of tipped a little bit when it got up there, which was interesting to think that it actually even landed, because right before that landing, they lost all communication and control of the vehicle. So it was kind of a huge success, even though it was seen as, well, it tipped over when it got there. And then the other thing you heard was, and the payloads only worked for 2 weeks, like as if that was a disappointment. So a lunar day is 2 weeks, and a lunar night is 2 weeks, and the lunar night is way too cold. No payloads have been built yet that can even survive the lunar night. So we have work to do just to understand how to be on the moon, let alone how to go further to Mars. And that's what we can do with all the science that we're doing right now. That's how we're going to get there.
And as a, one thing I want to add, as a Twyman said, and the ISS is a stepping stone, right? We need to maximize the use of the ISS to understand how we can tackle those problems for the time left.
So I was thinking, as Jana was talking, and Twyman as well, if you like H.G. Wells, he wrote a book in 1910. He was the first science fiction writer, and it was called The Man in the Moon. And they discover a compound called cavorite, which is a metal they've synthesized kind of explosively, actually, that covers the rocket ship so they can get to the moon. It's anti-gravity. And then they were able to use that, and they knew at that time that the moon had about 1/6 Earth gravity, and they knew that it was very cold on one side of the moon. But their question from the aliens to them when they got there to the moon was, why don't you guys all look the same? We all look the same, and that's why we can do stuff. And we're going to take you to our fearless leader who has all the ideas, and we imagine you have the same on Earth. And they say, well, we tried that, and it didn't work out so well. So it's an interesting book about the importance of different views in science. You see, we all have a different opinion. I have many opinions, but as you can hear. But I think what we really need to hear is, what is, you know, and Sheldon was alluding to this, what is the aha moment when you say, Sylvain, we could never have done this with simulated microgravity. We could never have made X, this algorithm on Earth without space and formula. So we could have never made a product, because it is an astrobiotechnology hub reunion. What is the value proposition for people here who are in biotech or high tech? What do you think is one thing where you think, could never have done that on Earth or understood that on Earth?
Well, I guess I was thinking what you were saying, and I may be off, a bit off topic, but one thing that happened recently, and I don't know if these data are out yet, so I hope I'm not releasing something that is not supposed to be released yet. But anyway, one advantage of microgravity is you can use centrifuge. And so you can use centrifuge to simulate a different type of gravity in space. And so what's been really interesting recently, and I don't want to give too much info, but let's just say that what was recently discovered is that by doing this experiment that can only be done in space, where you have zero G or micro G, they discover a change at the cellular level. There's a magic number where, let me just say that Mars and Moon will be very different in the impact on life, because we see that when you have too little gravity, you see these very strong reactive oxygen species in the cells. And then when you start increasing the gravity, and it's happening around the gravity of Mars, we start seeing now the benefit that we see on Earth. So there's there is this magic point that we're still looking for, and I think it's going to be depending on the phenotype you're looking for. So that's one phenotype, reactive oxygen species, but that study actually has looked at a lot of different things with animals being centrifuged in space. That's something you can't do here. It's impossible, but it's really, and it's called gravity as a continuum. Like, what are the changes through these 0 to 1 G? And what is the soft spots? Because that's going to be critical. Maybe living on Moon is going to be extremely difficult on the body, and Mars may not be so bad. And this is very important for information for us to know any exploration beyond Mars, you know, if we want to do it to exoplanets. So
let's follow up on that point, because you mentioned the cells that get reactive oxygen species also have enhanced self-renewal. Because they have symmetric divisions rather than asymmetric divisions. So that could be an advantage for stem cell regeneration. Self-renewal means the capacity to regenerate yourself or clone yourself. So a stem cell, you could enhance a good stem cell population. Of course, the other side is you could enhance a bad stem cell population. Yeah. But what are your thoughts about that? Because you mentioned that earlier.
I know. So that's something, the aging is actually probably something else that really links really well with space. And I'm kind of fascinated with, you know, all this work on pyrobiosis and the work that I got my PhD in Berkeley. So pyrobiosis was a big topic there. Mm-hmm. And but the concept of dormant stem cells and how you wake them up. And I'm wondering if really space could be one place where we could really try to tackle the aging question. And talking about, you know, application on Earth, I think this is going to be huge. If we can find countermeasure, as you were asking earlier, the countermeasure we're going to find in space are going to be pretty much countermeasure for aging. And so this is something very attractive to many of us, but because aging is not a very pleasant experience, I have to say. So that would be my take on this.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Well, and I'm going to add one thing there, because I love what you're saying. And I think when you mentioned earlier about the collective for patients, so we do the same thing in this community. We want the collective of all the data, because obviously, muscle cells are different from brain cells, are different from heart cells. So when you say stem cells, right, that's a big category. So as we try to put more emphasis on how we do work, how we look at different body systems, what are those mechanisms that are happening, I think that's how we're going to really break through this. And that's why it's important. Gene Lab, which is the NASA repository for all of this data, has started to really try to collect and put their arms around some of the more recent data that come from Kat and from Allison, Arun, who's in the room, and really see if we can see the trends and see if we can start to pick some things out. And that collective approach is what's going to really help us answer those questions.
And I want to add something there. Like, being at the National Lab, like, I've the privilege to see all the different proposals, all the different projects, like from bioprinting to cancer stem cells to brain organoids, like you name it, we have it. Like that, when I started, I said, oh wait, this is too much even for me. Like, I had to navigate all this amount of data. So I had two haha moments. The first one, when I sent the brain organoids, like, I mean, the project I was working with, and I started to see pathways that we were not really observing on those brain organoids on Earth. They say, oh, wait a minute, that this work really works? Because I was the first skeptical person, I need to be honest here. And then I remember, said, okay, we can try, but I don't know. I say, oh, wait a minute, this is the future. I really saw the value of this. And the second, when I started to work at the ISS National Lab and I saw all this amount of data and converging pathways and collectivities. That's why now I'm an advocate, let's say, for building this national network of innovation hubs from the West Coast to East Coast. We need to work together, because I, as an ISS National Lab, I cannot disclose the data of that group to the other group, but we need the researcher to be in the same room and talk together. That's extremely important to accelerate innovation.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add, actually, it's also important to be able to repeat experiments, because one thing that has been, I think, lacking, and Dr. Galuzzi and I, we were talking about it a lot, because we're asking questions. So has anyone done that? Yes, probably, but has it been published? Not necessarily, because a lot of people do one-off experiment, and it's often not enough to publish. And then so it becomes really important to really build that database, like Jenna was saying, with GeneLab, trying to find common pathways, like Davide was just mentioning, and being able to go up there more often to be able to build upon that. So SpaceX, thank you so much for all of those flights. But I think that's one part that is really important as well, to be able to repeat your experiments, to see if we can go up there a little bit more often to build on that, and
You know, I think for in terms of the aha moment, I won't answer in terms of a use case or scientifically, because you know the experts are in the or up here in the crowd. I think from a perspective that we have in terms of building equipment that enable this type of work, it's what Pinar is saying here. It's, you know, really even up to today, we're getting drips of information. We're getting directional knowledge. We're not getting the amount of data and repeatability that we need to really stand and you know, justify whether it's whomever, pharmaceutical or anything else like that. And that's one of the big things that our side of the industry, both in terms of building the equipment as well as the launch opportunities, just so that, you know, the time between new data and the repeatability is really a part of the side of the equation a company like us has really got to solve with others. But yeah, we've just got to create a lot more data, a lot more repeatability.
And Imad, what are you, I just wanted to get back
to me, all this is fascinating. And as I told you, I'm a newcomer. But what I'm concluding, and from my readings, my discussion with many of you, is really this adaptation capability from space to Earth and back. For example, the reactive oxygen species and the gravity. What's the connection for cellular rejuvenation?
Right.
What's the application? Can we, and this is really, to me, an open possibility to really treat diseases and even probably rejuvenation, trigger rejuvenation just by going to space and come back. Can we rejuvenate our cells, our muscle? Yeah, space promote aging in space based on our criteria, our biomarker that we use. But when they come back, cognition is recovered, muscle is recovered, etc. That's a lesson that that adaptation mechanism is really can be used for our benefit. And that's probably what we can tap into in the future.
So that's is getting back to your magic point, Sylvain. You may not necessarily have to go into space, but we can find the pathways that are activated in space that affect muscle regeneration and how to see if we can jumpstart it on Earth. But what we discovered, thanks to working with Axiom and our Sanford Stem Cell Institute, iScore Center, is that not everything is worse in space. Some things are better. And so we found some of the astronauts activated this primordial, very regenerative blood stem cell population. Mm-hmm. And it had to do with time and space. So there may be a sweet spot where space is not a bad thing. You know, for tumors, they proliferate quickly, but on the other hand, they proliferate quickly, so it may be an opportunity to enhance sensitivity of certain tumors to therapies and to discover new therapies. So in terms of the muscle regeneration part, have you discovered anything that could help with the sarcopenia loss or the loss
but
of muscle?
What I'm hoping with Rayana,
yes,
that we can design experiment, and hopefully with your help, in both areas. One is on muscle regeneration, mm-hmm, and experiment probably send satellite cells from sick patients, from sarcopenic patients, and see whether they can be reprogrammed, come back. Do they recover? Because one of the problem of muscle wasting and sarcopenia is satellite cells in muscle don't enter the regenerative process easily. They have difficulty. Can we reprogram that? For aging, for example, with Allison, now we're asking a question about senescence. Does gravity induce senescence? And that can we play with recovery and rejuvenation, whether gravity can trigger possibility to rejuvenate when they come back to Earth. That's really something we would like to explore. And these are, if I can say something, probably my dream with Rayana is we prepare the experiment, we design them well with you guys, and send Rayana to space station or another module that is available, does her experiment, and use that for her own PhD. And my understanding, she will be probably the first scientist who does that, does own experiment in space and defend her PhD using that. That's probably to address these questions.
Yes.
Wouldn't you hate to be on that PhD panel?
Exactly. There's
but
a
can you?
can you and ask a question.
Can yep. you imagine that the defense comes from
oh, that's
Jesus.
True.
Oh,
that's
there.
True. That's true.
That, imagine that. Yeah.
And also, Kat, let me, I want to introduce one provocatory point here. We are talking about aging, senescence, but also what about maturation? It's not necessarily the same as aging. Like, can we harness that as mm-hmm. well? Just mm-hmm. think about.
Yeah, directed differentiation. Jana.
Well, and, you know, this conversation is fascinating because I'm just thinking as you're talking about Rihanna going up and doing her thesis work, she probably should take her own cells and then we'll take her crew samples and we'll compare her cells in the dish.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. So Kat and I have talked about this many times because I think the connection between crew health, long-duration missions, exploration, and what we're doing at a cellular level are very important. And that's why, you know, the Sanford iScore team looks at crew samples as well as tumor organoids, brain organoids, making those connections. And I think that's the power of really helping us to understand what it's like to live in that environment. And I would just add that, you know, when you think about living and working in space, you hear a lot about, oh, it's so hard on astronauts. And it is. I mean, the truth is they have a lot that happens to their bodies. But in some ways, it's no different than terrestrial kinds of commercial fishermen or commercial divers that go for 6 months and, you know, in extreme conditions, or people who work in the Antarctic. They do it for short periods of time and then they take a break, right? And space is probably the same thing. I don't know that we're ready to completely live off planet, but as we learn to understand, 600 people plus have been on the ISS. They're all pretty healthy, and they go back multiple times. And so the other piece of this is that we can not only figure out benefit to life on Earth, but how do we tolerate those extreme environments as we go further?
So I just wanted to say one thing. So there are operational efficiencies that you really bring into play when it comes to these experiments, and you can develop new technologies or accelerate the development of technologies on Earth because of space. You know, I'm trying to bring it down back to ground so that when we're in our clinics, we can say, aha, Imed and Rihanna discovered that in space, and now our patients don't have muscle wasting, and we can apply that small molecule inhibitor. What tangible products, because we're talking about biotechnology, we've also got the Stem Cell Fitness and Space Medicine Center represented here. Thank you, Tatiana, for being here. She's looking at the better side of aging and centenarians and liver. What is a tangible product? We know Redwire is here and is doing protein crystallization in space. We saw Keytruda protein crystal structure resolved with PD-1, its target in space. That's a multi-billion dollar product. Let's get crass. Let's talk about money. So we're spending a lot of money in space to come up with erudite solutions to things that may be problems in the future in space. We're saying there's going to be benefit to humanity on the ground. What's the most tangible benefit monetarily? Where's the business case here?
I'll take that. So I often, when I'm asked this question, because right now it is very expensive to go to space, and it's also not frequent. In fact, to our SpaceX friends, when Starship goes up, I'd love to catch a ride on that every week dragon that's going up so that we can get more access to space. But the truth is, you can make novel products and compounds. Mm-hmm. You can do things process-wise. Keytruda is a great example of reprogramming stem cells. That all seems far-fetched right now because the cost of launch and the accessibility of space is hard. As that changes and we can make things in space that we can't make here on Earth, that paradigm is going to shift. And I like to use an example that I think everyone in this room will be familiar with. CAR T therapy, when it first came out, people said, no, too expensive, can't do that, can't use your patient's own cells. I was part of a tissue engineering company here in San Diego, and we thought if you didn't have a cell bank that you could just use for every patient, you could never make money with that model. So when CAR T therapy hit, and all of a sudden it saved someone's life, a whole industry figured out how to make it, distribute it, and even pay for it as an insurer. Space is no different. Mm-hmm. When we have that big breakthrough, we're not talking about incremental difference. It's a paradigm shift. It has to be something we really can't do here or else don't do it in space, because it is going to be more expensive. But when we find those opportunities to do things that we couldn't do here, and the logistics chain catches up to us, it's going to turn into a commercial space economy that's going to be pretty robust.
Yes, thanks, Jen.
And I just wanted to add to that point, Jenna, when we think about products that we can make in space that might be very costly, it's also maybe we don't need to do the whole process in space either. It really depends on which part of the process is really going to benefit from being made in space. So typically making products, small volume, high value type products will probably be the first ones and the ones that we should go after. And those will be, to Jana's point, all the worth doing it in space.
Mm-hmm. And we've done experiments in space together with cancer. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Of course. This was actually on my slide. I wanted to bring that up as well. So with Dr. James's lab, we have done three Axiom private astronaut missions. And in each one of them, we actually did many firsts. So I'm very happy to look forward for the next one. So actually during the first AX1 mission, we looked at the colorectal cancer and leukemia tumor organoids. For the first time, we used the microscope on the ISS dubbed Kermit, so which is basically a Kiasse microscope that you guys also have at the Sanford Consortium. During the second Axiom private astronaut mission, AX2, we actually did the first drug treatment on breast cancer tumor organoids, triple-negative breast cancer. And that was quite something to see because basically Dr. Jameson, during the first AX1 mission and the AX2, she had shown that the tumors were growing much faster in microgravity. In fact, were growing three times more compared to the ones on the ground. But even in that accelerated environment, the drug that they are currently developing, rivaxanib, was able to inhibit the growth of those and actually deactivate the pathway that they're interested in, ADAR1. And then in AX3 was also eye-opening because, I mean, it's funny because when the astronauts are doing these experiments in space, typically Jessica Pham and I will be at Leidos facilities who are basically managing the microscope on the International Space Station. So we'll be there in the middle of the night and on a Zoom call with Dr. Jameson and Jana and everyone and trying to look at these images live in the middle of the night. And what we have seen during AX3 was not only repeating the experiments to see if we can obtain the same results, but we have also sent for the first time breast cancer patient-derived organoids. So this was really the first time that we were looking at the kinetics of growth. And at the beginning, we were actually a little bit worried because we were like, oh, maybe they're more sensitive. Maybe these ones, we didn't catch the right timing for imaging. But then eventually we looked a little bit later in the timeline. We adapted because it was a private astronaut mission. We were able to adapt a little bit more the timelines. And what we have seen, I would never forget it. Dr. Jameson said, oh my God, the way that they grow, it's exactly like in patients. We were never able to see this on a dish. And I was like, wow, this is really eye-opening. So yeah, going back to the aha moments I've been meaning to also mention.
So that drug is currently under review by the FDA, working with Jana and Pinar, ISS National Labs, giving us that allocation to work up there. Our NASA partners accelerated the development of the first drug to be tested in space for patients with cancer on the ground. That ingenuity, that persistence, that resilience, that has led us to new discoveries. We've got some questions for the FDA we have to answer. As Jana was saying, we could make new therapies in space. As Pinar was saying, we don't have to make the whole thing. We just have to make part of it that accelerates the development where we can make parts of the products. I think you're going to have a lot of people wanting to work with all of you and people who want you on their committees for their PhDs, but also their business boards. I did want to ask, though, for the audience, we've got a few more questions that I could ask, but I'd rather open it up because Emed seems very anxious to answer other questions, and I'm sure Twyman does as well. But we've got Anna at the back. Hello there, from NSF, who I asked that business question for you. because she's always asking about the value proposition. Because if we're going to make a product, it has to be commercializable. We have to make it into a therapy that we can afford to deliver and people are willing to take. Sarah and our clinic, together with Paige, are going to have to deliver that therapy. And yes, CAR T cells are a perfect example, but we have small molecules, biologics. There's so many things we could do. Just wanted to open it up to the audience, just to see if Sheldon has a question. So we have a microphone that will come around to you. We have two microphones. Dr. Morris.
Yeah, hi. I was just thinking a good question would be, you know, what do you see as the biggest impediment or bottleneck to moving forward in this? I also think about, you know, as a traditional science, if you send your paper to review, they expect you to have like 30 subjects in there or 100 subjects. And here we have like 2, 3, 4. And so it just seems like it's hard to convince people that it's a real result sometimes too. But what else kind of impediments do you see as the biggest thing that we need to get through to make these breakthroughs?
Just to maybe start with two, and I know that everyone on this panel are going to have a lot of opinions, but I'm just going to mention two. One is the amount of launch vehicles that we have and the return that we have, which no pressure, SpaceX, Starship, anytime now. We're all ready, I think. But I think that's one of the biggest hurdles right now, to be able to get enough science up there and then enough science back, because right now for every two launches, we have one vehicle back. So that really is a limitation. And I'm just going to mention this other one too, because I think it's very important, and hopefully commercial space stations like Axiom will be able to answer some of these issues. It's also, when we send science to the International Space Station, typically we don't have a lot of analytical tools. The one that Dr. Jameson used for the first time, the Kermit, is one that is good if you have a reporter, for instance, like a GFP reporter, fluorescent reporter, to be able to see live what's happening with that particular pathway, or whether your cells are dying more, or if the neurons are more active for calcium imaging, for instance. But beyond that, we don't have too many tools that we can use on the ISS to get results in real time, and that is really an impediment to accelerate science, because then you have to wait to come back. You don't really know when that's going to happen. Like, for instance, we have right now SpaceX 33. That's going to be a 6-month mission. So then basically once you send your samples up with that flight, you have to wait at least 6 months to get them back, to start analyzing and getting the results, and then going back in line to go up on another launch. So that's a huge amount of time that you're wasting, versus if you have a lab that is equipped with cutting-edge technologies like you have in the lab here, then you might be able to get some of these results much faster and iterate. And
So I think there is another bottleneck. Is I heard it first time from Allison when he came to CAUS in October, gave a great seminar, and he finished his seminar with something: we need to train scientists to become astronauts. And this is my understanding, and I became also a big advocate of that idea. And this is, we need probably to open up programs where we train our scientists to become astronauts. So when they go up there, they troubleshoot on spot, experiment, and even they can probably salvage some experiment that maybe normally will be lost. And that's probably would be huge benefits, in my opinion.
Can I really something? Saw this with Rayana while she was up there, so I didn't mean to cut you off, Silvan, okay. But Rayana was, to the earlier point that Jenna was making, but she was like simply amazing. I think it also depends on each person, how they adapt to microgravity. And I've been always scared of going to space. I'm not one of those people who wants to go to space. I'm here good on Earth. But once I saw Ray operate at the Life Sciences Glove Box, which is basically the hood on the International Space Station, I was like, oh, wow, maybe I can go. But like, she seems so much at ease. But
that's why CAUS, for example, and in Saudi Arabia, I'm promoting this idea around her, we can be part of this program to train scientists, one of
absolutely.
The hubs. And collaboration, really networking for experiments that will be sent to space, because it's expensive and requires a lot of expertise. So avoid competition in certain subjects and network to send experiments.
Absolutely. For Sylvain, we're just going to let Sylvain.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that also, it's not only the scientist, but it's also the hardware designer, because
Let me give you an example. To me, fluidics is not fully understood in space, and it's actually, nanopore technology was surprised to have better sequencing in space. They never understood why, but they had better read. There was lower drop there, so open question. The fluidics is different. We don't have good mathematical model for the fluidics. We have some models, but it's not fully developed. So think about, to me, what would be great is having more space, bringing bigger payload, where you could actually have the developer of actual tools developing in space. So for instance, a printer, once you're in space, I don't know if you've seen our astronaut playing with liquids in space. They can approach, they put the water and it's floating right there, the bubble, and they can approach it from any angle. You suddenly have this full three-dimensional access that you never do when you do printing on Earth, where it's always gravity is driving you in one direction. This could be totally exploited by, you know, very sophisticated software and hardware that could really print. So imagine you start with an organoid, you can actually start growing the blood vessels around the organoid through a printer. I mean, none of this is possible on Earth. It's just forget it. It's never going to happen. But you can do it in space. But for this, I think you need to have the hardware folks actually living in space and designing in space. So it's not only the scientists. I think it's the entire group needs to go there.
Yeah. So Twyman's a hardware designer. Are you going to space, Twyman?
I'm happy to. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, and I think what you're hearing, and to your point, Sheldon, so the ISS, you know, when it first got started in 1998, because it's been 25 years now that people have lived in space, it really wasn't designed for translational research. And that's what we're trying to do on the ISS now. And that's why there's challenges. But that's why the commercial space stations, VAST, Axiom, Starlab, those capabilities need to keep up now with the state-of-the-art science for translational medicine. Because we've kind of opened Pandora's box by saying, look what we can do here. And so I think you're going to see a lot of the challenges we face today on ISS. I love the ISS, right? It's the only place that we have to do science right now. But it looks like someone's 20-year-old garage. I mean, it's messy. And there's not a lot of space, and there's not state-of-the-art equipment. There's not high-throughput equipment. And to Sylvain's point, you know, we need to leverage even fluidics and high throughput and ability to get the most science out of every mission that we can on the ISS. So we're kind of trying to ride a tricycle up a big hill right now, but hopefully we'll be on our speed bike as we get to the commercial space station.
Final comment to Sheldon's question from
One thing, you know how many companies like they want to be on board and say, I'm sorry, we don't have space in space. Like, we need that. We need to do proteomics. We need to do transcriptomics. We need to do, you know, real data transmissions. But we cannot accommodate. That's why also we are waiting for this continuity moment toward the new platform orbiting Earth. Because we can do more, definitely.
I have a question. Oh, there's a question in the back. But before that question, what about doing clinical trials in space? I mean, we talked about there may be benefits for being in space. Who regulates that? How do we do that?
So that's a big discussion around the microphysiologic systems and organoid models that we've talked about. You know, you could use a personalized medicine approach and getting those models up there and being able to really look at individualized patient responses and tailor drug therapies to a patient, or to look as a clinical trial with a group of patient lines that would help to direct you to where the best maybe opportunities would be. Last night I had a great conversation with Alex Kalesi about
Bruce here.
Yep, the advances that are being made even in understanding differences in genomic profiles, right, across different disease states. That's really going to accelerate our opportunity to understand how to treat diseases and even understand the mechanisms that are causing those. And if we can accelerate that in space, then we've just got a great opportunity to help patients.
Right. Actually, we've got a couple of questions from the back. We'll maybe have you answer that question as well as the one at the back. You go ahead.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to say thank you. First, before I start asking a question, I'm going to say thank you, everybody, for this beautiful, awesome opportunity to talk about biology, technology, and space. And everybody who's put it together.
Thanks.
So a little bit about me. I'm Dave Beck. I am the branch chief for Space Access Mobility Logistics for U.S. Space Force. out of Los Angeles. I'm here with my colleague, Dr. Brady Estevez, who invited me. And I really want to help a lot in build out space development and research for biotechnology, because I'm part of ISS Space Group, Working Group. And one of the challenges I've seen with the three space stations is that we probably need to look at doing a dual approach like we do for technology insertion. Maybe have a space station where half of the space station is for research development only, and the other half, other part is for the proliferation of space technology. We give you a really good hands-on and a good research incubator for getting students to get up in space and learn more about the operational side of technology while it's being conceived. So we talked about at Space Force about doing some in-space manufacturing. Right now, there's no money available for that, but one of the things I want to talk to some of the private investment funds is about putting dollars together, maybe an international effort. I talked to my Canadian colleague from Canadian Space Agency today. I spent all the morning talking to her at a meeting in L.A., and we talked about doing collaboration on the science side to build out the space side so that we can get more people involved understanding how important space is. I'm a stem cell donor, and I see how important it is when I donate a stem cell to save someone's life, how important the research, very much so, that you are doing here today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I think you have 9,400 employees just up at Vandenberg, don't you?
Are they somewhat like
covering
that.
The entire coast? Yes, we have new partners here who are taking an approach that space matters for accelerating technological development and advances. So thank you so much for being here, both of you. We really appreciate it. We look to collaborate with you locally because, you know, you're having more launches just up the coast. So we'll be able to retrieve a lot more and do more science so NOAA can go into space and help. We'll be training the next generation of scientists. I know there's another question here. You had a question? Somebody? Yes, go ahead.
As a lay person, I was prepared for a science fiction afternoon. how esoteric is it? Is your science disseminated? Is the public informed? I don't think so. And to pivot a little bit, how absurd is this, the funding with the federal government? Is it going to be, is it a lot of just noise, or... I'm just amazed that the work is being done, and we have those shenanigans, you know, just cutting funding and doing. I just can't believe it.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for that comment. This is why we really appreciate Catherine Canjo really allowing us to share our science in an art space, because this helps to make science more accessible so that it doesn't seem so intimidating, but it also throws us off as scientists because then we can't be so, you know, into our own jargon. We really have to change how we talk about science and what the value proposition is, which is all of us on Earth, and that we need to do this quickly because we have a sense of urgency for people that needed answers yesterday. So absolutely, science matters. We are here to save science with you. The public matters. Your voice matters. We need to be able to galvanize our resolve to make sure we keep making new discoveries about the genomic advances that Jana and the, you know, chair of neurosurgery here, who's constantly saving lives, Alex Kalesi. He has to be there on a Saturday just because he's the best surgeon in the country. You know, this is what he does. But, you know, we have to have better solutions for everyone and be able to preemptively strike as much as possible. So the one thing is, necessity is the mother of invention, or maybe the father of invention. I don't want to be sexist here. But it means that we all have to work together because of funding constraints, which is a great thing. And the more we work locally, nationally, globally, the better. We'll get there faster. We combine different opinions. We say, nope, that didn't work. Larry always tells me way ahead of time, that's never going to work. You know, but these are things that we do together. So you're exactly right. If you can help us to communicate with the public, we're all the public. Catherine's helping us here. We will put this on YouTube. We will put it on every available network. And who knows if actually anybody will watch it. But even as Noah was saying, just if somebody, and Alex was saying, and Justin was saying, just if somebody takes notice that they are part of their own solution and can help others, that's what we want to convey here. So I know you had another point you wanted to make.
But where is the media today? why this thing is not covered.
Yeah, so the media comes after, you know, sometimes they for our first astrobiotechnology hub, we had the Washington Post. The media is a little distracted right now. But we have, you know, we're going to put this on YouTube, and maybe the media doesn't matter as much. You matter. We all matter. People look at YouTube. I hate to say it. I mean, I like to say, not hate to say, we have 200,000 views from one stem cell aging lecture on YouTube. We have a lot of hits from what we do, and maybe by, you know, the media is important, very, very important. Don't, you know, let me convey the wrong message here. But you're also important. You tell a friend, they tell a friend, say, hey, look at this. It's going to be on YouTube. Tatiana's experiments are on YouTube. These are all things. This makes science accessible, but Sylvain and others were alluding to, we have to put the data into the public domain. If the public purse is paying for it, we want to be able to share the data and share it in real time. And, you know, that's those are things you want to do. Sorry. Debbie there?
No, yeah, I want to add something in terms of the media. Like, I have an interview every day with different media across the globe, really, from Italy to Spain. So the information is out there. And also, if you go to theissnationallab.org, we curate, like, every science we do on board. We have a magazine that goes out. So every information is out there. And nowadays, it's increasing in coverage. ISS National Lab is committed as far as today, business as usual, you know, with our grant programs, igniting innovation, tech dev development, our STEM education program to create the workforce development of the future. That's why also, like, my effort on national level to create this working group on connecting innovation hubs, but also cross-pollinating students with new technologies, VR, digital twins, so people, they don't need to travel, but they can put a mask. You have some there. Yeah. And they can actually pipette and simulate what is going on station. Like, this is like very much like covered and out there, and the media are, like, they have interest on that.
Yeah, so we do have a space panel at South by Southwest. That's 345,000 attendees. Some of them are in person, I think quite a lot. So we'll be doing that. So there's just generally more interest, but for a lot from younger people who just want a new type of career. They think this is cool. So I think you'll see Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, not the conventional styles of media, but the truth is out there, and we'll make sure it's heard. So we're going to take a little break now because we're going to the Mind event. I'd like to thank all the speakers and people who asked questions for attending. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.